When I was in boot camp in the service, I don't know why they call it boot camp, maybe because they walk all over you there or something, they call it boot camp, but when I was in boot camp in the service, the conditions were particularly demanding. Now, I wasn't in the Marines, and so I wasn't in Paris Island. I wasn't in that kind of demanding conditions, but at least compared to the conditions that were generally available, our particular company seemed to have been singled out for special treatment. Our company had finished first out of about 16 companies in our brigade for the past three or four sessions of boot camp. And our company commander, the commanding officer, was absolutely determined to do so again. He had his own way to do that, and we didn't exactly understand what was coming, but he worked us extremely hard. He gave us very few privileges, and every privilege that we had to earn. When you went into the Army back then, they shaved your head bald, kind of like Rich here. Shaved it all off, and I remember cutting my hair shorter before I went in so that the transition would be easier for me. You know, I cut it down kind of short because I was trying to grow a ponytail at the time. And so to make that transition, I cut it down a little shorter so that then when they shaved it off, I could handle it. Everyone else got their hair shaved when they started, and then it started to grow back out. And our company commander kept shaving ours every week, and we never understood why we were still bald and everybody else started to grow hair. Somehow, I guess I was supposed to teach us something, I'm not sure what. We trained longer than everybody else. When we'd be out on the parade fields and you had 16 companies marching up and down, left, right, you know, forward, back, all those things you do. And then one by one, the companies would leave the parade field and go back to the barracks, and we would be the last to leave. We would march after everyone else was gone. We would eat late. They took us on night training. They worked us very, very hard. We had almost no free time at all. And every minute was filled. And some of the other companies began to have time to go to the, I forget what they even called it there. They had a little PX or store where you could go and have a, you know, buy some candy or have a soda or something. And we never got to do that either. And it was rather, frankly, after a while, we were getting pretty irritated. 8 weeks of training, and we were watching everybody else begin to have privileges and do things, and some of them even had weekend passes off of camp, and we couldn't even get out of the company grounds. And we were approaching the last part of our 8 weeks of training, and we decided it was payback time, that our company commander, so proud of his record, had bested all of these other companies three or four times in a row in the entire brigade there. And so we just decided that we would flunk the final competitive testing. That would pay him back, tarnish his record. It'd be a way to say goodbye and do so with a smile. Well, this was kind of underground decided. It kind of filters through the barrack, and we just decided everybody'd be minding their, you know, manners right up to that time, and then we'd just run a little slower, do a few less push-ups, not go quite so fast across the bars, and all those things you had to do, and pay him back. Word leaked out. There were some blabbermouths in the company somewhere. Told the drill instructors, and the drill instructors told the company commander. And he called us out on the parade field, and he began to talk to us. Again, somehow or other, he found out what we were going to do, called an assembly. And he began to tell us why he was working us so hard and why he was demanding so much. And he began to list names of friends of his who were dead, who had gone to Vietnam and were blown up or killed or shot or in some way lost in the course of the conflict. He began to go through people that he knew that were injured because of, indeed, they had either stepped on a booby trap or they had gotten themselves in a place where they had been harmed or they had been off duty goofing off and something else happened. And he began to go through and he began to describe what it was going to be like to go to Vietnam, to go to war. And he began to show what a contrast that would be between our civilian life and what we were used to and what a radical change we would have to make to be there and to do well. And he spoke, and he went on for a period of time, and he convinced us that what he said was true. And we went out to the competitive testing that finished that session, and we placed number one in the brigade, just like everybody else had before us. Even though we almost hated the man, he came to show us, and he made us believe that what he was doing was actually for our own good, and he inspired us to actually try to serve him and to complete his goal and his mission as he laid out. It was an astounding thing. I didn't think he could do it. I was ticked off. I did not think that he could turn that around. But he did, and we served him. In that way, he motivated us to want to follow him, and we completed then that task. Now, what he did went beyond authority. You cannot, with authority, force a person to excel. You can't do it. You can tell them, you can beat them, you can threaten them, but you cannot make them excel. What he exercised was leadership. In that way, in that environment at least, I would say true leadership. He made us want to follow him. He inspired us to strive to excel on his behalf and for our own good. Now, all of us exercise some measure of leadership and authority in our lives. It might be in our own homes. It might be in our jobs. It might be here in the church, here in our own environment as we stand. That authority, though, is often limited by our own attitude and approach, by the way that we exercise it, by the way that we relate to each other. We can demand in our homes that our children obey us. I can make my children obey me. I can do that. I can force them to. But I cannot demand my children that they would love and respect me or Michelle, either one. I cannot demand that of them. They must be willing to do so. That's something that has to be, in that sense, earned and inspired. Our mates, as well, within our marriage relationships, may cooperate with us, but a proper relationship with them cannot be demanded or forced. Brethren, we must learn to encourage and to inspire, to lift up and to instill confidence. We must learn to lead in such a way so that others will follow. I strive to teach in such a way as best as I can with what God gives me to. I strive to teach in such a way that you will actually be willing to listen, want to listen, desire to listen. I don't want you to have to sit here and go, oh, I will try to get something out of this. There must be some grain of value here if I really concentrate. I really strive so that you will have an interest and a desire to do so. Brethren, we need to do that in our lives. Even God is not satisfied to just force us to obey him. He could do that. He has all the power there is, and we have none, and he can force us to do anything he wants. But God is not satisfied with that approach. Notice back in Deuteronomy 5. Deuteronomy 5 is where the law is given, the second giving of the law as such. The commandments are given again to Israel. They're across the Jordan River and looking over into the promised land. And Deuteronomy 5 and verse 22 goes through all of the commandments and says, "These words the Lord spoke to all your assembly in the mountain from the midst of the fire, the cloud and the thick darkness with a loud voice. And he added no more. And he wrote them on two tablets of stone and gave them to me." So Moses here is reminding them that this came from God. They sat there before the mountain of Sinai and he reminds them of what their response was. "So it was when you heard the voice in the midst of the darkness while the mountain was burning with fire that you came near to me, all the heads of your tribes and your elders, and you said, 'Surely the Lord our God has shown us his glory and his greatness, and we have heard his voice from the midst of the fire.'" Israel said, you know, that was a pretty dramatic event. That was incredible. And we were really impressed with what took place. "We have seen this day that God speaks with man, yet still lives. Now, therefore, why should we take any more risks with this process? You know, therefore, why should we die? For this great fire will consume us if we hear the voice of the Lord our God anymore. We're going to die." And they said, "Moses, why don't you talk to God and then you talk to us and just tell him what he said?" You know, God had the power and the authority to make them do as he pleased, but God wanted more than just fear. Fearing God is a very important commodity and it is a necessary issue, but God wants in that contest a willingness to submit ourselves to him. A desire to submit ourselves to him. Goes on down, and God again remarks in regard to Israel, their attitude and approach, says, "Oh, that they had such a heart in them. Oh, that it was deep down inside their own character that they would fear me and always keep my commandments, that it might be well with them and with their children forever. Oh, that they wouldn't just be afraid of me, but that they would fear me in a godly way and that it would be in their heart. And that they would desire to obey me." God isn't satisfied with just making us obey. Why do you think he gives us the freedom to choose? Therefore, we can choose to obey or not to obey, and obviously, some have chosen not. 1 Peter, chapter 5, and verses 1 through 4, here is instruction as to those who would shepherd God's flock, his people, who would serve him in this capacity, the elders. And again, notice the attitude and approach that God desired. It says, "The elders who are among you, I exhort, I who am a fellow elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ, and also a partaker of the glory that will be revealed." He says, "Shepherd the flock of God which is among you, not as overseers, not by constraint, but willingly." He says, "I don't want you to obey me just because you must, because you have no choice and it is a burden to you." He says, "I want you to serve willingly, not for dishonest gain, but eagerly. Not as being lords over those entrusted to you, but being examples to the flock. And when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the crown of glory that does not fade away." Brethren, the Bible in many respects is all about leadership. How we exercise leadership and authority, how we work and worth and serve each other, how we prepare to lead and to rule in the kingdom of God. Robert E. Lee is very famous through the South. I've lived in Tennessee, and I've had duty stations in Louisiana and Georgia, and I've lived twice in Texas. Robert E. Lee is considered by many people to have been one of the greatest military commanders in modern history. I realize that our feelings about the Civil War and slavery may well color the way we personally view him. From a historical perspective, he was still a great leader. Let me remind you that George Washington, whose picture I see all of the time in this state, was also a great leader and had slaves as well. If I remember correctly, George Washington freed his slaves on his deathbed. Rather convenient. When his life was over and all things were finished, and yet he was a noble man. There's other times and cultures, there's other circumstances which we don't ever want to resurrect, but still existed just the same. Robert E. Lee was serving as the superintendent of West Point prior to the Civil War, and President Lincoln, seeing a conflagration coming and seeing a problem now arising, offered Lee the command of all U.S. forces. He was offered that position first. He resigned his commission, though, instead, and accepted the command of Virginia's forces in the South. Militarily, he was a genius. Funk and Wagnall's cheap dictionary I have, because you could buy it at the supermarket years ago for a dollar or something. I was looking at it today as I was going through my notes, and I thought, you know, that dictionary now has got to be 8 years old. You can get a used Britannica on the market for 8 years old for cheap, so I think I'm going to chuck it now that it's used. But I'll use one last quote on Robert E. Lee. It says that he was probably the greatest single factor in keeping the Confederacy alive through the 4 years of the American Civil War. Now, I'm sorry that he was. I'm sorry that he was that strong of a leader. I'm sorry that he was that good, but he was. I still think we can learn from some of the character traits that he had. One of the reasons he was so effective is that he was able to inspire his men to overcome enormous odds and to endure severe hardships in the course of their military service. Toward the end of the war, in the defense of Richmond, Lee had faced Grant for almost a year. And if you've ever gone back and read the accounts of the Civil War, some years ago they had the Civil War on TV, on public television, and it was stunning to watch. And I remember being glued to the set sometimes for hours watching that played out before me. But Lee was completely outmanned, outgunned, outprovisioned, and yet he held out there in the defense of Richmond for almost a year. And some things just stick in your mind and they run through your mind and you think about them from time to time. For whatever reason, and I'm a northern boy, I grew up in the Northwest, but for some reason the retreat of the Confederate forces from Richmond as they were encircled by the Union troops, because I've read those stories and I imagine those soldiers after having been undermanned and under-rationed and under-provisioned and marching down those roads and a Union troop circling in from the sides and the trains coming in with supplies and the trains were cut off and, and they didn't get their supplies, and they're walking around with a few kernels of grain in their pocket, and that was their food, and they couldn't stop. I mean, if you had to stop, you had to catch up in the line, and they're trudging along, and it was a tragic, tragic time, and all the suffering that came out of that war. But Lee had been outnumbered 3-1, out everything except out commanded. And there was an example of his leadership even in his defeat. One of the books I read that's in my library at home is Memoirs of Robert E. Lee. I want to read you. This was compiled by one of his generals, so it's a rather favorable history. It'd be like me writing about my mom or somebody, you know, I'll give you the good scoop. But fact is, you can look up Britannica, you can look up a lot of different sources, and you're going to find that Lee had a very noble character to him and had a very, very high standing among any place where he had served, North or South. It says, no commander was ever more careful of his men, and never had care for the comfort of an army given rise to greater devotion. He was constantly calling to the attention of his authorities the wants of his soldiers and making every effort to provide them with food and clothing. The feeling for him was one of love, not of awe or dread. They could approach him with the assurance that they would be received with kindness and consideration, and that any just complaint would receive proper attention. There was no condescension in his manner, but he was ever simple, kind, and sympathetic, and his men, while having unbounded faith in him as a leader, almost worshipped him as a man. These relations of affection and mutual confidence between the army and its commander had much to do with the undaunted bravery displayed by the men, and bore a due share of the victories they gained. They didn't stay in the saddle as long as they did because they had so large of an army and so much gear and all these provisions. There was a desperation of their men that fought under his command that had a quality of its own. It really and truly did. And I say almost unfortunately so. Whatever other qualities a man may have, he cannot be a great soldier unless he has the power to win the confidence and to inspire the enthusiasm of his men. General Lee had his power. Few men have had it to a higher degree. No privation or suffering or disaster could shake the confidence of his men in him. In the darkest hour, the sight of his form or the mention of his name stirred the hearts of his veterans. They spoke of him with an affection and pride that has not been dimmed by the lapse of years. You know, I could find a book and I could read you a bunch of glossy sentences out of it. From the study I've done, these sentences are reflective and true of a circumstance that then existed. 3 days after the surrender of the Army of North Virginia had dispersed in every direction, and 3 weeks later the veterans of 100 battles had changed the musket and sword for the implements of husbandry. It is worthy of remark that never before was there an army disbanded with less disorder. Thousands of soldiers were set adrift on the world without a penny in their pockets to enable them to reach their homes, yet none of the scenes of riot that often follow the disbanding of armies marked their course. You know, they didn't have a way home. They didn't have money in their pocket. They didn't have provisions. They didn't get repatriated by the commanding army. They simply were released and they walked home. And yet there was no riot or pillaging as they went. Since there is a sort of infallibility in an undivided popular judgment, and the whole South looked to Lee as its greatest man. So impressed was Grant with the devotion of the Southern people to Lee that after the surrender at Appomattox, he sought his influence, being convinced that if he should advise the surrender of all the Southern armies, the advice would be followed immediately. And in his report of the operations of the Army of the Potomac in 1864 and 65, he attributes it to General Lee's example that, as he says, in a quote from Grant, the armies lately under his leadership are in their homes, desiring peace and quiet, and their arms are in the hands of our ordnance officers. When Lee said it was over, and the men went home, and incredibly, an army turned on a dime from war to peace. It's an incredible example. I do have a Britannica that was like 1910. It's a research edition of Britannica. They don't get cheaper back then. They get more expensive going the other way. But I looked it up in there, and it says under the article, Robert Lee, says his personal influence over his men whom he led was extraordinary. No student of the American Civil War can fail to notice how the influence of Lee dominated the course of the struggle. Friends and foes alike acknowledged the purity of his motives, the virtues of his private life, his earnest Christianity, and the unrepining loyalty with which he accepted the ruin of his cause. It's quite a statement. Lee fought his battles with military tactics, but he led his men through the power of his own influence and his personal example. We lead, or we fail to lead, by our personal example as well. Our patience, our fairness, our perceived courage, our willingness to stand in the right place, our moral principles are generally evident for all to see, and we have the Word of God, which is effectively a handbook on exercising proper judgment and leadership. And I think it's important that we look to the Bible and that we look to God's Word and that we look to leadership as to what our responsibilities truly are. I was looking in my file as well, and I found in there, since we started with the Ten Commandments, I found a list of the Ten Commandments of human relations on how to really get along with people. I went over to pick Megan up yesterday evening from being over at a friend's house, and her friend's father greeted me and said, "Well, hi, Mark. It's good to see you." And inside the house, he mentioned Mark two or three times. And as I walked out the door, he said, "Well, Mark, it's good to see you. Take care." And you know, I couldn't remember his name. And I really felt like an idiot. And so I went home and immediately asked Michelle his name. And I just went over and over and over my mind. I'll never, ever do that again with him. Ten Commandments of Human Relations, and how to exercise leadership socially, and it just gives 10 points on things that we ought to be sensitive to. And notice these. You won't be able to write them as fast as I say them. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 10. No. But think about it. You'll recognize it. Speak to people. There is nothing as nice as a cheerful word of greeting. This is social leadership. Smile at people. It takes 72 muscles to frown, only 14 to smile. Smiling is more restful. Call people by name. The sweetest music to anyone's ear is the sound of his own name. Be friendly and helpful. If you would have friends, be friendly. Be cordial. Speak and act as if everything you do is a pleasure. Now, when someone gets up here to speak, whether it be me or the sermon or anybody else, do you want it to appear as if it's a real burden? And that we struggled in the church and that we finally showed up and yes, oh boy, I hope we get through it. No, you don't want to hear that. It doesn't matter what happened. It doesn't matter if my car blew up on the way to church or if Michelle threw my clothes out the back door or if I had to sleep on the couch. It doesn't matter, you know, if somebody called right before I left or if I walk in the door and said, you know, so-and-so just committed suicide. Hope that's all right, you know. It doesn't matter what has happened. The fact is, what is encouraging to us, generally speaking, and we talk with each other at times, heart to heart, but what's encouraging to us is when someone is able to perform and serve in their function and do it well and make it almost seem as if it was light. Now, that's the facts. What president did we have that made their job seem like it was duty and willingly working but a sacrifice to do so? Well, you might have your different picks, and this is my opinion, but to me, by the end of Jimmy Carter's term as president, he looked like it was tearing him to shreds. He looked wore out. President Reagan came in and made it look like it was fun. He joked and laughed about the presidency, and Sam Donaldson would try to tear a hole in him, and he'd laugh at Sam as well, and everybody took him well. I was listening to the radio yesterday, and Dr. Laura was on, and this lady called and said, you know, my child has shark's teeth, was born with pointed teeth, and he goes to school. She said, I'm afraid the kids are going to make fun of him. I want to rebuild his whole mouth. And my husband said, no, that's a waste of money. And Dr. Laura said, look, teach your child when somebody makes fun of him to say, if you don't give me a break, I'm going to bite you. She said, teach your child to laugh it off, and you'll find, if you can do so, you know, she said, you'll find that your child's toddlers will actually befriend him and take him as a friend in most cases. Be friendly to them in a laughing way. Make it lighthearted and humorous, and people will like you. Be generous with praise, cautious with criticism. Be interested in people. You can find something to like in everybody if you try. Some people you have to try a little harder, but try. Be considerate with the feelings of others. There are three sides to a controversy: yours, the other fellow's, and the right one. Be thoughtful of the opinions of others. It will be appreciated. Interesting conversation I had with someone this week. I told them about Megan and Derek, and they told me about their children. And then I told them about Megan and Derek, and then they told me about their children. And I just realized after a while that we had just carried on a conversation, and both of us were just expressing what we wanted to say. And the other was, and it was funny after it was done. I thought, well, that's interesting. You know, we do. We focus on those things that are important and critical to us at the moment. It says, be alert to give service. What counts most in life is what we do for others. Obviously, that's fundamental focus of the church. Now, we all have strong and weak points. We all have flaws, and we all have great blessings in terms of the things that we have to give and serve. We need to look at people's strengths. We need to commend them. We need to be generous with our praise. It's so easy to focus on weakness and failure. We need to encourage excellence. And we need to strive to be patient with insecurity and fear. Now, for me to say that is almost hard to say, because I know my culture and my background, and all of us boys came out of an environment that was a little broken, maybe a lot broken, if you'd talk to my brothers. And every one of us came out of there with an absolute burning desire to succeed, just a burning fire to do well. And we went different directions to accomplish that in different ways. But, brethren, we must be patient with each other, and yet all the while strive and encourage that excellence be something we work towards. One of the sermonettes at the feast was on quality, I think it was, and how important quality is, and how important it is to God, and how important it is in our character, and how we should strive for that. We need to encourage the building of confidence and enthusiasm in others, again, by focusing on their potential for success rather than just the risk of failure. What in your mind is one of the fundamental differences between a person with high and low self-esteem? I like self-worth. I like the concept a little better than self-esteem, but self-esteem is the vernacular. One of the fundamental differences there is the way they view their failures. People with high self-esteem tend to minimize in their mind their failures. People with low self-esteem tend to maximize their failures. Now, you can do that internally or externally. If externally you continually maximize a person's failures, then you encourage that process as well. One time I was playing golf, and probably for the first time in my life, and it never happened again, I got a quadruple bogey. Huh. Quadruple bogey. Bogey means you missed the hole. Quadruple means you should have hung your clubs up somewhere else. 10th hole, quadruple bogey, frustrated me. In fact, I don't even play golf anymore. I got clubs and they store in my garage, and I find other things to do with my time. But anybody want to buy said clubs? 10th hole, it ruined my whole game. 11th hole, rah, 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 rah. 12th, rah, rah, rah. You know, I'm golfing around. I'm not really paying much attention. I'm trying, but frustrated. And I finished the game, and I looked at my score, and I had a normal score, about 112. No, I don't know what it was, but I had a normal score. I was probably bogey golf for the whole day. And to me, bogey golf was a good game, and I couldn't believe it. But I didn't enjoy any of it because of the bad hole, and I focused so much on my failure that I didn't even notice that for the next 8 holes, I was hitting the ball and it was going in. I completely missed it. And I didn't know until I added all the score up and realized that I had a normal score and that I'd actually played better than average because I made up that deficit at the same time. And that was kind of a stunning thing to realize. Sometimes we do the same thing with guilt or frustration in our lives. We focus on a point so much that even though we might be doing better after that, because we focus back on the failure of the moment, it overshadows our life. One of the basic differences between a person with high and low self-esteem is the way they view their failures, the way they focus on the obstacles that they faced. Proper leadership has a lot to do with developing teamwork. There are obstacle courses that are set up that you cannot run alone. Now, there's some kind. You run through the tires, you jump over the bar, you swing across the rope, you do it all by yourself. But they've designed obstacle courses, and the military used them first, but now executives use them, corporations use them, and they send management teams through the course. And the only way you can get through there is with a team. In other words, if you've got five people, all five of you have to get across each obstacle in order to complete the course. And some obstacles are set up where it takes two or three people to perform a function. And it's used to build teamwork and identity and camaraderie. And a number of corporations, again, have begun to use these types of things to build teamwork and leadership in their own management positions. Ecclesiastes 4. Notice just in principle what is being addressed here. Ecclesiastes 4, verse number 9. It says, two are better than one because they have a good reward for their labor. If they fail, one will lift up his companion. But woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him up. Again, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? Though one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand him, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken. Why do you think Satan attacked God's church and scattered it and shattered it into pieces? Because as the church divides, the strength of unity, the power of numbers and force of being able to produce in many ways is divided. Well, sure, anybody can have individual gain and service to God, but the fact is there is power in the body in a way that does not exist individually. One of the members here called me up this week. We were discussing, actually, I guess I called her and was talking to her, and I asked her if I could relate this, and she said I could, so I'll just leave the names out, but it's interesting. She told me that there was an acquaintance of hers, and I got the impression that it was from somewhere outside of our body here, our church. But an acquaintance of hers asked her if I was going to stay with United. And I thought, nobody else gave me any other offers, so, better hang around right now. But so she mentioned this to a couple of other ladies in church, and they were all talking together, and one of the ladies said, well, she said that, in her opinion, I would stay where the truth was. And another lady that was talking says, well, in her opinion, she felt that I believe that it was important that we stay together to do the work. And all I can say is thank you for portraying me as I am. I will stay where the truth is. And I do believe it is important that we stay together to do the work. I think it's critical that we do that. I don't think we can do that at the cost of our beliefs. We faced that once before. But I do believe there is a power in the association. There's a power in the body that gives us some opportunity that simply isn't there otherwise. And that's why I'm here. But I'm also here because I am able to obey God and do so in a completely clear conscience, according to what I understand. I used to take Toastmasters magazine. Don't take it anymore. I used to use it when we had club. I was clubbed to death, so then we don't have club anymore. We have leadership class we started up. But at that time, the president of the Toastmasters organization wrote a little editorial in their magazine, and he made an illustration, which is interesting. It says, one Clydesdale can pull 8,000 pounds. Two horses together can pull 18,000 pounds. Now, I don't know anything about horses, so I'm just trusting if he's willing to put this in print, he must have some basis for it. Maybe he had to retract it the next week. I don't know, but I suppose it's true. One Clydesdale can pull 8,000. Two together can pull 18. That means two are actually pulling together more than each individually. He says, but they resent working as a team. Trainers say that if they have a week to train the horses to work as a team, that together they can pull 25,000 pounds. In other words, even though they don't get along perfectly, they can pull more than each would individually, but if you can train them and get them to cooperate and work together and pull at the same time and lend their power to each other, that you overcome that inertia that is there, and once you're moving, you can actually pull even more. I thought, again, that's part of why I am where I am. Everybody has to make their call, but that's part of why I'm here. I believe we have to pull together. I believe it impacts what our opportunities are going to be. Years ago, a minister and a friend taught me about the example of Nehemiah in the Bible. And he says, look to Nehemiah when you want to study leadership. He says, be like Nehemiah if you want to be a leader. And he says, I want you to carry that with you. And so at the time, the material he gave me and the discussion that we had was rather extensive, but I'd like to share with you a little bit, at least in part, the example of Nehemiah. Let's go to Nehemiah in the book, Nehemiah 1. I believe Nehemiah is one of the best examples of leadership in the Bible. And I think it's important for us. Nehemiah 1, verse number 11. Nehemiah here is praying because of the trauma of his people and the problems in relocating to Jerusalem and restoring God's work and temple in that area. And verse number 11 just shows that he was the king's cupbearer. The last part of that verse. Now you think about the king's cupbearer. You think, oh, here's a servant. You know, somebody comes up with a waiter towel on his arm and hands the king the wine. And it's not like that. That's not what it was. The king's cupbearer was a highly trusted personal aide. In other words, one of the easiest ways to poison someone was through their wine, because the strength and the color of the wine would cover that up, and it would be very quickly assimilated, and you could put them out. And so, in that sense, the person who served you your wine was the closest possible trusted aide, because in some ways he handled your life in his hands. And so it's somebody that you trusted and relied on in a very personal way. Nehemiah was a great leader, a great servant of God, used in a very high position in a number of ways. Notice the first of the chapter in Nehemiah 1. It says, the words of Nehemiah came to pass in a month here of Chislev, in the 20th year, as I was in Shushan, the citadel, that Hanani, one of the brethren, came with men from Judah. And I asked them concerning the Jews who had escaped, who had survived the captivity, and concerning Jerusalem. Now you remember, Jerusalem, Judah went into Babylon to captivity, and they were released from captivity and went back to the land to rebuild and to restore and to reestablish the nation. And so Nehemiah is concerned about their progress, and he asks about them. And they said to me, the survivors who are left from the captivity of the province are there in great distress and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem is also broken down. Its gates are burned with fire. And so it was when I heard these words, I sat down and wept, and I mourned for many days, and I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven. Throughout the book, time and time again, when Nehemiah came to crisis, he turned to God first, and he besought God's understanding and God's will, and he tried to turn his heart to God and cried out for his people. But he always turned to God first. What's the first commandment? We shall have no other gods before him. That's what that means. It means that you will go to God before anyone else. And in all things you will look to him first. And you will trust him first. And you will believe him first. And you will worship him first. It doesn't just mean you won't worship an idol, because we don't worship idols. Our idols are different. Our idols are this society and this society's values and this society's possessions and those things that we desire that eat our time and change our focus. But it says that he went to God first. The very first thing he did was drop down and submit himself to God and cry out. And we see that throughout the book. Nehemiah 2, verse number 11, he goes to Jerusalem personally to try to see what the issue was at stake. And in verse number 11, it says, I came to Jerusalem, and I was there for 3 days, and I arose in the night, had a few men with me, and I told no one what my God had put in my heart to do at Jerusalem, nor was there any animal with me except the one on which I rode. And I went out by night through the valley gate to the serpent wall, and he goes through around Jerusalem, where the wall existed, even where it was torn down. And I viewed the walls of Jerusalem, which were broken down, and its gates, which were burned with fire. And I went on to the fountain gate, into the king's pool, but there was no room for the animal that was under me to pass. There was so much damage and refuge and so many blocks in the way, you couldn't even get through. You couldn't even pass. So I went up in the night by the valley and viewed the wall, and I turned back and entered the valley gate and returned. And the officials didn't know where I had gone or what I had done. I had not yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, or the others who did the work. He went out to see for himself what the problem was before he really decided how to proceed. And then I said to them, you see the distress that we are in, how Jerusalem lies waste and its gates are burned with fire? Come and let us build the wall of Jerusalem that we may no longer be a reproach. And I told them of the hand of my God which had been good to me, and also of the king's words that he had spoken to me. And they said, let us rise up and build. Then they set their hands to do this good work. He encouraged the people. He addressed them in such a way when he understood the problem so that they were willing to respond and rise up and go back to work. You know, that's not easily done. It's not casually done. Chapter 3 talks about how the wall was rebuilt. He went around and got everybody involved, gave everybody a piece of something to do, something to function, but he got them invested. He got them invested in a very personal way. But notice again, it says Eliashib, the high priest, chapter 3, rose up with his brethren of priests, and they built the sheep gate, and they consecrated it and hung its doors. And it says next to him in verse number 2, and it goes on, and next to them in verse number 4, and next to them in 5, and on, next to them in verse number 7. It just says, you know, so-and-so went here, so-and-so was next to that, so-and-so was next to that, and Joe and Harry and Susan and all these people lined up, and they began to build side by side on the wall. And they all dove in and began to restore their protection. Down in verse number 28, it says, beyond the horse gate, the priests made repairs, each in front of his own house. Now think about that. You're out there in Jerusalem, and there's nomads and bandits and enemies all out there, and the wall is broken down in front of your house. Now, if you get a chance to work on that wall, where are you going to build the fastest? Right in front of your front door, because that's where they're going to come through and get you first. So he actually took people that had a vested interest and he gave them something to do right in front of their own place. Verse 29 says, Zadok here in front of his own house. Hananiah goes through here, and after him, Meshulam made repairs in front of his own dwelling. Those people who have a vested interest in a particular area will serve the hardest. That's why I believe so strongly in the use of volunteers. Because someone who volunteers to do something will generally kill himself to get that job done because they invested themselves. Give someone a job to do that's in their field, that's in their interest, that's in their perspective, and they will do it. Who needs to run Sabbath school? Somebody with kids. Who needs to work with teens? Somebody with teens. Who needs to work with media? Somebody in media. I mean, if you have those things, those are the people that will really sacrifice themselves to produce. And so, I do think very highly of the focus of letting a volunteer have a chance to produce and to perform and to serve and to sacrifice in the area that they desire, because I do believe it oftentimes it works. Chapter 4, verse 19. He taught the people to work together, and by his own example, he worked right with them. Chapter 4, verse 19. Then I said to the nobles, the rulers, and the rest of the people, everybody, top to bottom, regardless of rank or position or opportunity or blessings. He says, the work is great and extensive, and we are separated far from one another on the wall. Therefore, wherever you hear the sound of the trumpet, rally to there. Our God will fight for us. He said, you know, we'll have to work together to defend ourselves if that time comes, because we're scattered on this project. So we labored in the work. Half of the men held the spears from daybreak until the stars appeared. Half were on guard and half were in the active work of the construction of the wall. At the same time, I also said to the people, let every man and his servant stay at night in Jerusalem, that they may be on guard by night and working by day. Hey, don't go back out there to your home and out there in your property. At this point, we have to rebuild the center. And he said, so stay here until we finish our task. And you can share duty at night. You can guard while others continue on in their work. And he said, and neither I, my brethren, my servants, nor the men of the guard who followed me, he said, because we are here as well, he says, we didn't even take off our clothes, except that everyone took them off to wash. You ever done that? Have you ever had clothes and the job or the task that you had at hand was so intense and so busy and so demanding that at night you literally just laid down and did not even undress, and you got up in the morning and went back to task? I've done that. I've done that for, hate to tell you, I've done it for weeks. Where at times you literally just laid down, you don't even take your clothes off. And you get up and you go. And you say, oh, that takes a second, fine. He's in a circumstance here where people didn't have their homes finished. People didn't have comfort and convenience yet. And where the task was extreme, it's like an army marching on forced march, and you march until you almost drop, and you just lay down there, and you share off some guard at night, and then you pick up in the morning, you march again. Very extreme circumstances. But he says, you know what? Since you have to do it, he says, I will do it too. And so will my servants and my guards and everyone that is with me. We will work as hard as you do. And he inspired confidence in the people. And they responded to him. And they built the wall. And they restored Jerusalem. Nehemiah's example is unbelievable. He faced what they faced and sacrificed as they sacrificed. And he was very careful to choose those who would lead those people in such a way that they were servants of God as well, so that that might maintain itself. Chapter 7. Then it was when the wall had been built and he hung the doors, when the gatekeepers, the singers, and the Levites had been appointed, that he gave charge of Jerusalem to his brother Hanani, and Hananiah, the leader of the citadel, for he was a faithful man and feared God more than many. Though the men who had leadership were picked because of their dedication to God, not because they were managers, not because they were smart, not because they were gifted, but because they had gifts, yes, but they put God first. And he let those men be the leaders of the community. When you go back and read history, and you study some of the accounts, Nehemiah, and even biblically when you put this together, Nehemiah came, worked with the people, rebuilt the wall, and he went back home. He fulfilled his task. And when he went back home, Jerusalem went back into decay. And so Nehemiah then returned to Jerusalem and stayed there apparently until he died, to serve those people and to guide and lead them and to be their governor so that they would remain responsive to God, because he had a gift of the ability to inspire and to admonish in a way that was effective and productive, and the people respected and admired him, and he stayed there apparently until he died. He led the people in such a way that they were willing to turn to and obey God. And brethren, I believe that we must be striving to do so as well. That's what our job is too. We were not just called to salvation, we know that. We were also called to do a work. And by that I do not mean the work as to what form of media we may choose to or choose not to use. I'm talking about that part of God's creation that begins with us. We are in process. He is creating us as part of his kingdom, and we are there to help others to attain that same blessing and opportunity. We need to learn to serve God willingly, openly, proudly. I left a little pause here because I heard last week when I paused in Kennewick, everybody up here wondered if the transmission was broken, so I just thought I'd show Kennewick what it was like to be a pausey sermon, but I couldn't read my notes last week, and I'd have to stop and focus, and so there'd be a few seconds break, and everybody'd wonder if the line went dead, but it didn't. But we need to learn to serve God and to lead God's people the way God leads us, and to teach people and help them to respond, not forcing ourselves, but indeed drawing people in that way to greater conviction, to help and to serve in such a way, to be positive and encourage in such a way that it encourages that and that process to take place in others as well. And we focused recently on a group in India who appear to be striving to serve God, and it brought to mind, in my mind, a group of people in India that we mentioned once before, some years ago. And I went back to the Good News Magazine. It was in the March, April 1988 Good News Magazine. There was an article in there on a group of handicapped people in India, not in the church. This was simply an example of people striving with what they had to give to succeed, to exist, to function. There was individuals there, or an individual that didn't have any hands. There was an individual that didn't have any arms. There was someone who didn't have any legs. There was someone there who was mentally retarded. There was someone there who was blind. And they all banded together in a particular shop and were producing and making certain things. And there were some who could sit up and be strapped to a chair and use their hands because their legs didn't work. And there's others who really had problems emotionally and mentally that they couldn't focus, but they were strong enough to carry things. And they all banded, and each person had something they could contribute to the whole. And by doing so, they all survived. And it would appear in that environment, if they had not done so, they would have all possibly died or been in great distress. You know what the article was on? It was on joy. Is it joy? They were writing about someone with no hands and no legs and no feet and somebody else who can't really focus. And the article is on joy because they had managed to work together to produce. I think we're better off than that. I think we're a whole lot better off than that. I think it is critical that we approach these council meetings in such a way of beseeching God's will that we would submit to it, because the whole church is better off than that. So let's work together. Let's see what we can do. Let's see what we can produce. And let's do it in such a way that we inspire each other to respond. Because we have no authority. I have no authority really over you. Your life is going to be what you choose it to be. And if you walk out the door, you walk out the door. If you walk in, you walk in. And all I can do and all you can do for each other as we do this together is to encourage and inspire each other to be responsive in the best possible way that we can, to grow spiritually, to be more dedicated, not less dedicated. Because we are in a culture and environment at a time in the church, brethren, when people tend to wander. And by wander, I mean in their convictions, wander in their zeal. It's so easy when we don't have the deadline written down in stone to top and say, well, fine, I'll just do this and I'll do this. And oh, there's all these other opportunities that I'll simply take in before the end. And I want to be careful about that. I want to be focused. True leadership is not just being in control. It's not just having power and authority. True leadership is learning to motivate and to inspire, to contribute and to share. It's encouraging others to do what is right. You know, even our children can learn to lead in a right way. They can learn to respond. One time, one of Megan's friends was over at the house, and her friend said, "Oh, God." Just as people say it, you know, they use it as part of their vernacular. And Megan said, "Don't say that in our house, okay? We don't say that." Now, just for the record, I'll often tell you where I have succeeded and where I have failed. With my family, I'll generally just tell you the bright spots, simply for my protection when I get home. So, when I say such, I'm not saying, you know, I have these great circumstances, everybody's perfect, and when I tend to use Michelle or one of my children as an example, I will tend to use a positive example for my own safety and protection. And then when I tell you about my life, I tell you a little more of a package. So don't think I'm one-siding it for anything other than selfish reasons. But it was interesting because, you know, our children's friends come over and play at our house a lot. Michelle took last week about six groups of kids skating all together, and because she's in a position to do so, those kids play a lot together. They come over to our house, and they know, and they're at your houses. You've grown up this way. You've lived this way. Your children have grown up in an environment like that. But kids come over, there's something different. Because we're not allowed to do this the same way that I do on the school grounds or out back. And our children would actually stop and say, oh, don't say that. Even, hopefully, when mom and daddy are not necessarily always there. But we don't say that. That's not right. And the kids are come over very polite and well-mannered. It's a pleasure that they're there. God is motivating and inspiring us to do His will. He's leading us. We have salvation available to us now, but it's not yet available to everyone else. And we don't know who God's going to call and what process He's going to use. But I am here in part because a woman led me to God's church. She showed me by the way she lived her life that this had value and that it worked. She led me into God's church. We can argue all we want. God calls. I know God calls. You know that. God had to open my mind. Fine, but it didn't look like it worked to me until I saw somebody live it. And that's leadership. She couldn't make me do anything, but she caused me to want to do something. And it was an important part of my life. I believe our leadership has an impact on some of those whom God would now be able to in the future call. I believe our congregation has an impact when somebody comes through and they sit down right here. The degree to which we are indeed friendly and warm and nurture those who walk in the door, the degree to which we have an environment that is conducive to Christianity and worship of God is going to nurture and encourage those indeed God might call. And it might be enough to actually keep them in the door because of what they have found here. That's leadership. It's leadership that is very critical and important to us. We need to strive, brethren, to be inspiring in the sense to inspire each other in our service to God, both to fulfill our own calling and also to make way for those who are yet to come. I'm tired of that too. I'm tired. It's all a sermon I can stand. It's been nice being with you, Kennewick, and those of you on the phone hookup. That baby said it's time to end this one, so the sermon will finish.